Is it really that time of year again? Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the Algonquin roundtable of music, telly, film and books. I'm Andrew Harrison and this week we will be digging into The Deuce, David The Wire Simon's exploration of Manhattan's Times Square in the depths of its porn and prostitution period of the early 1970s. It's on Sky Atlantic now. We'll also be looking at the new album by St. Vincent, aka Annie Clark. Does Mass Seduction confirm that we're in the presence of the 21st century Kate Bush or the Waitrose Lady Gaga, or both at the same time? And a BBC 4 show, which does exactly what it says on the tin, Nile Rodgers' How to Make It in the Music Industry. Is it fun? Is it entertaining? And will we all be pop stars by the time you hear this? But who is this we, then? I refer, of course, to our special guests for the week. Hannah Verdier is a seasoned pop and TV writer and a graduate of the smash hit School for Gifted Youngsters. These days she ploughs through literally all the telly for The Guardian, which means that she has square eyes. Hello, Hannah. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Has TV reviewing killed the joy of actually just blobbing out in front of the telly and emptying your brain?
I must admit, it has a bit, but there's always the Kardashians.
There's always the Kardashians.
There always is.
Isn't there must be sort of endless material in the Kardashians, then. Is it kind of like ongoing Turner Prize
art installation? Oh, it's beautiful. I went to their art installation, strangely enough, the other week at the Saatchi Gallery. It was very good.
Yes, okay. Perhaps we can look at this in another separate podcast. Also joining us, music, travel and politics writer Andrew Mueller. The best thing to come out of Wagga Wagga, New South Wales, since Dame Edna Everidge. She actually is from Wagga Wagga, isn't she?
It is pronounced Wagga Wagga. To correct you somewhat. And yes, the fictional character of Dame Edna Everidge is among many great Australians who have hailed from Wagga Wagga.
On a Radio 4 programme yesterday, they gave the derivation of the Australian word willy willy. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, it's like a small tornado. Yeah,
I was most impressed.
Really?
It's a kind of load of straw or dirt or whatever blown along a street, isn't it?
Yes, so it's an extremely small and ineffectual tornado. We should make clear you do not hasten to your basement at the approach of a willy willy.
So when Australians hear the sweet little willy willy won't go home, it has a different meaning.
It means a whole other thing.
Fantastic. We're learning things today. You heard him then. By the way, he's here every week, making sure that our flux capacitor operates within acceptable tolerances and parameters. It's our producer, the Doc Brown podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you today?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you.
Jolly good. Are we charged and ready to go back to 1974?
Yep, I'm about to reinvent the skateboard.
Fantastic. Okay, well, before we start, a quick reminder about another show from the Big Mouth stable, Remaniacs, the no-bullshit Brexit podcast for people who won't just shut up and accept the so-called will of the people. We've just launched a crowdfunding appeal for Remaniacs via Patreon. Have a look at remaniacs.com. If you donate a small amount, you'll help us to develop the show, explore live events, and get to more people, and we'll send you swanky Remaniacs mugs, t-shirts and other stuff as well. That's at remaniacs.com. Okay, Matt, fire up the DeLorean for New York in 1971, specifically the Times Square Vice District. David Simon's new Sky Atlantic show The Deuce looks at the pimps, pushers and prostitutes at a moment when the old-fashioned sex industry is mutating into the modern pornography industry. In the manner of Vinyl and The Get Down, The Deuce is big on verisimilitude. It really does look like it was shot on the Mean Streets era, when Times Square was the filthiest and most depraved place on Earth. Does it deliver as rich a viewing experience as the show that made Simon an international name, The Wire? We're going to see after this from the soundtrack. This is Curtis Mayfield with Don't Worry, If There's a Hell Below, We're All Going to Go. If There's a Hell Below, We're All Going to Go by Curtis Mayfield, as Matt was just saying, when it's playing the perfect opening music for any radio show of any kind anywhere.
Yeah, including that one about dead people on Radio 4. I think that would be perfect for that as well.
Can you imagine how much cooler the Today programme would be if it started with a blast of Curtis Mayfield?
Yeah, or The Reunion, or Gardener's Question Time,
you know,
or Moneybox Live. If There's a Hell Below, We're All Going to Go.
It'd work pretty much every time.
Anyway, on to pornography. Yeah, thought for the day, definitely. Well, actually, that is your thought for the day. If There's a Hell Below, We're All Going to Go. Thank you, Giles Fraser. Anyway, The Deuce. Let's get into the healthy world of pornography. Hannah Verdier, The Deuce. You've seen a lot of this show. You were early on this, weren't you, doing it for The Guardian. Set it up for us.
So, in the way of The Wire, it's got a slightly muttery thing about it, but it really is so evocative of the period. It reminded me, I was so excited to start watching Vinyl, and then I just gave up on episode 2.
Mm.
But I think this really delivers the atmosphere of the time. Not that I can remember it. The real thing, I just think... Yeah, it's brilliant. I think episode 2, which I think is just aired, is where it really gets going as well. That's when it kind of the setup ends and the porn starts, really.
So essentially, we have, in the David Simon manner, we have strands, don't we? You've got Hawkers are in Times Square itself and their surrounding world of pimps. You've got another strand involving a student in the free love, you know, campus radicalism era. You've got James Franco as this Harris barman whose twin brother, played by James Franco, is on the hook to the mob for a load of money. And this struck me as initially kind of quite a TV-ish setup, you know, in that you've got things that are going to be driven forward by very familiar narratives. It's not going to have that David Simon sprawly thing. And then it starts to sprawl. It starts to open out and you follow the little tendrils, don't you?
Yeah, it goes all over the shop. And I think I was watching it with ready to complain that it was exploiting women, because I love complaining about that sort of thing. But even with my...
It gets you out of bed in the morning.
It does.
Even with your woman hat on.
Even with my lady eye on it, I think it's all right. I think they've got away with it. I mean, Maggie Gyllenhaal is the... She's the goddess of the piece as Candy.
She's Candy, the alpha prosy Candy. Yes.
Yeah.
The woman without a pimp.
I know. And although
there's a slightly whore with a heart of gold touch, which I found a little bit.
Yeah, there has to be a child, doesn't there?
Yeah.
There has to be a child at home that she's sending money to. But then again, I think it's really hard to portray women, the whole myth of she's powerful because she's making money off men. It's like, I find that a little bit ridiculous anyway, but I think they pull it off the way they do it.
I mean, this is a strange question.
And she's got great hair.
She's got a great wig, let's say. She's got a great, you know, it's hard to sort of ask this question about such a relentlessly seamy, grim, exploitative show. Did you enjoy it?
I did, actually, and I think the moment that I really loved it is when she actually starts. She's a stand-in for someone on an artistic movie.
Yes.
And you can just tell she's really fascinated by the cameras and the way the lighting works and everything, and she really gets into it and enjoys it. And also, I learnt about them using cold potato soup for the money shot.
Yeah, let's not get too into too much detail. Family show. Yeah.
Of course, but it was
educational too. You are listening on Saturday morning.
Pushing aside their plate.
Got off already.
Yeah, no potato soup for me at lunch today. Andrew Mueller, is this the David Simon show you're expecting?
Yes, pretty much, and I mean that as the highest of compliments. Obviously, I was one of those annoying people who was about 5 years late to the wire after everybody else, and then went around telling everybody how fantastic it is, and they all said, "Yes, we know. We told you 5 years ago." And for that reason, I think once you've gone through the whole The Wire thing, and especially if you are one of those people who watched it a couple of times, as I did, you become... It's like, I think, with any sort of auteur or artist, you become tuned into their way of thinking and their way of writing. And so it's kind of easier to absorb, because I do remember sitting watching the first episode of The Wire the first time I saw it, just absolutely baffled. It took me about three episodes to figure out that Avon Barksdale wasn't Stringer Bell, for example. So there was a lot, but once you start to get attuned to what he's doing, and the thing you mentioned of having James Franco play two characters who are identical brothers, I think is a hugely amusing and extremely characteristic touch. And I don't think it's giving away too much to reveal that one of them gets given a picturesque scar over the forehead quite early on, so you can
spot
the you can tell them apart. It's a very, very Sliding Doors moment, that one, really. Although the milieus are obviously quite different.
Slightly different.
I mean, I've only seen the pilot so far. I'm sort of saving the rest in the doubtless vain hope that one day I'll be able to watch it on television, because I'm a Virgin Media sufferer and therefore cannot see Sky Atlantic. Or really look at things on Wi-Fi. But, yeah, I thought it was great. I think it shows every sign of being spectacularly good. And the topic is, and I think this is an underrated thing, in the same way that The Wire, I think, was a great study of modern America. I think, though this is obviously set several decades previously, it's going to be a great study of how not just modern America, but the modern West, or actually the modern world, got to where it is. Because I do think when histories of this period are written, the impact of pornography is going to be a major, recognized as a major driver of our times.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about porn for a bit. There's the question mark over this show is, we're in at a time when, rightly, the question is asked everywhere, why do women only get to play prostitutes, you know, victims, victimized wives, and all of these kind of subordinated roles? Here is a major TV project where, you know, it is central that the women are playing prostitutes. Why make this now?
Simons and his co-writer, George Pelikanos, there was a really good feature stroke interview with them on them in The Observer a couple of weeks ago by David Smith, The Guardian's US correspondent, and there was a big interview with him. They talked about this, and Simon says, basically, Simon says, that, put your hands in the air, that in the same way as The Wire sidestepped whether the drugs are bad, drugs are good question, because you had to, because actually that wasn't the thing that was interesting him. That's just a given in human society and culture, and actually it's the politics around that that was the thing that was kind of that interested him. He said exactly the same thing happened when they started talking to him, and they went and met a guy who was, the basis for James Franco's, one of his characters, one of the brothers, who was telling them all these stories. He was involved right at the beginning in that kind of era at Times Square, and was talking about all these characters that a lot of the characters in the finished program are based on. And Simon was saying that basically, in the same way as if you get into a program that is that starts discussing is prostitution good or bad, is pornography good or bad, you kind of get about bogged down in that, and you have to sidestep it and go, this is all about power. And if you look at where the thing that he says that's interesting is that it's an industry where the product is the people.
Yeah.
So it immediately puts a kind of spin on it from his point of view that makes him kind of think, oh, this is intriguing, and these are where the stories are.
In the first episode of the pilot, you know, I was thinking, I don't really want to know about the sensitive inner lives of pimps who stab women and beat women. I'm not really interested in that. And it did actually feel rather exploitative, the first episode. But as it opens out and you start to understand that this is far from a standard morality play, and that every character in here, ideally, as happened in The Wire, everybody's going to get to play their story out to the ultimate. You start to realise that you know, so judgments like that are kind of foolish. They're reductive. If you haven't watched the whole thing, if you haven't experienced the whole thing, you can't sit there saying, well, it's a shame they're making this.
Yeah, I think it managed to not exploit, if that is ever possible as well. I mean, there were moments of violence, and I'm always really cautious of that sort of thing. When there's a naked dead woman on a slab, I always think, don't go there again. But yeah. I don't think it was like that. I think it was done really well.
Well, Pelicanus has said that they tried to, you know, he said he's totally aware that someone somewhere will be getting off on it, but they tried to make the sex stuff as boring and as unsexy as possible.
It's functional. You can see them looking for the camera.
The way they
angles.
Shoot it, they shoot it for, you know, both within the porn that they shoot, but also within the kind of other scenes. They can't try and keep it, really.
It's boring and it's squatted, and occasionally it's ridiculous. The first porn film that she shoots with a pair of Vikings and fucking her. Not too much of a story, you haven't seen the second one.
Spoiler alert.
I know, yeah. I mean, let's Maggie Gyllenhaal for a moment. I mean, this is, without going into too much detail on special effects and props, shall we say, she really gives herself to this role in no uncertain terms, doesn't she? And I was initially watching this going, my God, why is this woman sort of subjected herself to such a, shall we say, demanding role, and certainly a demeaning role? But it's certainly, you know, as the story progresses, as you see her character grow, you can see why it is a genuinely attractive part to play.
And also, she's not, throughout her career, she's not shied away from taking on roles that other female actors may well think that's not going to look good on the CV.
Yeah, she does not take the easy option, does she?
So what do we make
secretary?
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring up secretary here, but that's a good film.
Yeah, and she's executive producer on this as well, as is Franco. So they've clearly, this is not just something that's landed on her desk. Mm. This is kind of, she's clearly committed to the whole thing. Do we think we're going to get the thing that everybody always says about David Simon is, it's so Dickensian. You know, every aspect of the society is explored. The Wire changes from a cop show into a show about education, into a show about the docs, into a show about the press. Is there capacity on this one for it to do that, for it to go off and look at other aspects of New York in the 1970s, do we think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, because I think, as I said earlier, if you look at that period from the modern period, the aesthetics of pornography have infested every area of popular culture. And I do think one of the things that remains to be seen is what effect they have on generations of people who've grown up with this as normal. I mean, I am so irrecoverably ancient that my entire adolescence, you know, happened well before anybody invented the internet. I really genuinely struggle to recall having seen any moving picture pornography throughout my entire teenage years. I mean, where the hell would you get it from? Whereas it must be now part of the daily media diet.
You'd get it from a hedge.
You'd have to go to a booth.
Yeah, but not moving.
Yeah, that may be a British tradition.
In the wind. That may be, flickering in the wind.
I'm aware of this British tradition of finding pornographic magazines in hedges, but it may have been different in Australia.
You don't have hedges, that's why.
Well, not as many. I don't know where they were kept, basically, if not in hedges. But it is now part of, and if you speak to people who are teachers or who work with kids or indeed have kids, they know that this is a thing, that this is now part of the daily media diet. And there's an argument to be had about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's sure as hell a thing.
Yeah. I think in the same way that they're taught that the Wire did a kind of 5-season arc, they've already planned out seasons 2 and 3 of this to take it up to the kind of 80s.
Yeah.
So it goes into the kind of whole video cassette explosion. So I think, you know, they are planning on kind of the long arc, as it were.
Hannah, why is this good when vinyl was bad? And why are film and television makers now concentrating on this mean street slice of New York? Why is it so fascinating and attractive? Because we had this, we had the Get Down.
Yeah, I think it's maybe we're all missing it a little bit. When you look at Times Square now, it's so sanitized. But I think with vinyl, I think it was you didn't care about the characters that much, but here you do, and not just because, oh, look, they're gutsy and they're making their way, they're making their living, but it was like, oh, I've invented glam rock, look at me, and this is, I think, is a bit more authentic, really. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, vinyl was, to me, what made vinyl so dull was it was just a bunch of stock Scorsese characters swearing at each other and kind of alpha maling each other.
Yes.
And there was no element of humour in there, whereas in The Deuce, every kind of interaction is kind of undercut with some element of humanity. Like the bit where the low-level mafia guy is intimidating James Franco, in a conventional show, that would involve some form of a beatdown or some kind of a minor shooting.
Yeah.
But actually it kind of plays out with a kind of weary humour. They both know where they are in the game. You know, the mob guy knows he does not need to sort of spell out the nature of what awaits James Franco if he doesn't cough up. And there's something quite workaday about it, but you know, the mob, the sex industry, the growing porn industry, they're all workplace dramas.
That's true, and I think it harks back to that innocent time, like Andrew was saying, before pornography was everywhere. And I just think that was a time when it was in its rightful home, if you will, where it wasn't in your face, so to speak, and people could choose to watch it, and it wasn't all over the internet for 15-year-olds. And I think, what an innocent time. I like it.
The good old days of innocent porn.
Yeah, it's more of a choice then, I think.
So who's going to stick with it? I think I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. But if Andrew does follow it the way that he said he was going to, i.e. kind of wait until it turns up somewhere else, he's only doing what David Simon does, because apparently he watches very little TV and he waits for things to end and then one of his mates to go, yeah, that was really good, they knew what they were doing and they got to the end properly, rather than starting something and then halfway through going, these guys haven't got a clue what they're doing, and giving up in disgust.
But that's a good tactic, actually. It means you avoid the whole moment when the shark jump occurs.
Yeah.
If you're told afterwards that they never jumped it, then you're safe.
Well, writing with an end in sight is, I think, a massive rarity. I discovered to my horror when 24 was a thing that not only do showrunners not know what's going to happen at the end of, for instance, I don't know, Lost or Star Trek Next Generation, they'd be shooting 24, not knowing what was going to happen at the end of a 24-hour period. You know, it's set in one day.
That's dangerous.
And
still,
and at notionally at 11 o'clock in the morning, they don't know what's supposed to be happening at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. No wonder.
You'll have days like that.
Here's a puma, etc. You know, anyway, let's move on and let's get back to now. Our guests always bring in a tune of their own to play, a personal editor's recommendation. Hannah Verdier, what have you got for us?
On a disco theme, I've got a bit of Marilyn Manson for you.
Raising the tone.
Yeah. So he's on his 10th album, and I think we need a bit of Mazza in our lives more than ever at the moment. He's challenging, and this little number is about as funky as it gets.
Well, one would not ordinarily imagine a discotastic Marilyn Manson, but let's give it a go. And this has the jolly title of
Kill For Me.
The soothing sounds of Marilyn Manson with Kill For Me as chosen.
He does now have something in common with Curtis Mayfield, of course, keeping the theme moving along in that a piece of stage has collapsed on him.
Ah, God, I don't know if you're going to be able to edit that one.
That's too early, not in regards to the Manson thing, but too early still in the case of Curtis.
Oh, God. You were talking about a headline.
Yes, I do not endorse this at all, but at the time of Curtis Mayfield's mishap with stage equipment, the NME's headline, and I think I'm remembering this rightly and not unfairly traducing my former rival paper, was Curtis Mayfield struck by lightning. In fairness to them, they may have not at that point realised the severity of his injuries.
We do not endorse this sort of behaviour. Let's move on. St. Vincent, a.k.a. Annie Clark, is an artist who defies both description and classification. I did a quick call-out for three-word descriptions, and what I got back included: one woman Eurythmics, provocative pop polymath, definitive broadsheet catnip, It's a Street in Glasgow, Kate Bush Now, and indeed the Waitrose Gaga, all of which seem to be simultaneously true. A series of brilliantly disturbing albums have established her as someone to reckon with. Will her sixth album, the bigger, louder, more electronic mass seduction, seal the deal? Let's have a listen to one track. This is Los Angeles. Los Ageless by St. Vincent's from the album Mass Seduction, just out this weekend. That's a lot more electronic and epic than some of her past stuff. The ambition is palpable. Andrew Mueller, is she going for the brass ring, as they say?
Almost certainly. The trouble is, at this point, I'm reminded the last time I came here to do Big Mouth, we talked about Laura Marling, and I kind of feel like you could just cut-paste everything I said about Laura Marling and drop it in.
Brilliant.
About St. Vincent.
Hang on, they could save be us different.
But my response was the same, in that I listened to it and I thought, this is good. And it's interesting and intelligent, and there's clearly a sensibility at work here, but I don't really care about any of this, and I'm never going to listen to it again.
Okay, Hannah Verdi, do you care about this? Are you going
to
listen
pretty
to
much
again?
What he said. No, actually, I thought this was a real banger of an album, but I really, really enjoyed it. I've been not immune to her charm so far, but I haven't loved her, but I think the way she's taken it a little more electronic, as you say, and it's just... it's absolutely brilliant. And for me, being in the celebrity world, she's got a backstory, she's got some exes, so everyone's going to be wondering whether it's about the exes and what's going on there.
But I wondered about this. Do you have to know or care about any of that stuff to properly enjoy the record in itself? Because I don't know or care about any of that stuff, and I did vaguely... I mean, I did do my research, Andrew. Mm-hmm. I did read around her, but I wondered
five
if she's...
5 minutes Googling.
Yeah, as it's technically known. But I did wonder if she's one of those artists, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, those artists do exist, but at some level you need to be invested in them as an idea and as a story to entirely appreciate the work.
Do you know what? I don't think you do, though. I think that's just like a little bit fluff on the corner there, because I think this album, it stands alone, and she won't say who it's about or what it's about, and it could just be all coming out of her head. You know, people don't have to write love or hate songs about certain people, do they?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not particularly invested in this. All I know is she went out with Cara Delevingne for a bit.
And Twilight's Robert Pattinson.
Is it? Who's he? Is he in Faith? Is he in Faith?
Is he young?
Is he? When we finish this, going down to take your place on the high bench.
Absolutely, with me big crisps. I mean, I'm not invested in the story, and I thought this was a fantastic album. I couldn't stop playing it. It's so exciting. The songwriting is incredible. The melodies are amazing. There's a track called Pills, which is singable, and it's about
such a
big
jingle.
Pharma and a pills. There's a beautiful, beautiful song called... what's it called? Hang on a minute. Happy Birthday, Johnny.
I like that one. I did like the slow ballady non-disco ones.
Well, this appears to be about either a brother or a cousin or a family member.
That is a great song.
Is a drug casualty, and it's so heartfelt and beautiful, but melodically so amazing. I was just completely, bowled over by it. She is a little bit of an intimidating character, though, isn't it? Why do you think people find her perhaps unapproachable? Is it because she's... just, is it the mystery?
I think she's quite mysterious, but also she's everything she should be. If you say she's the Waitrose Gaga. You know, she
that
really
wasn't
is.
Me.
Of course not. I enjoyed all those descriptions so much, though. But she's, yeah, I think she's got that mystery about her, and she's very sexy, and she's in control, and I just think she's great. I really like Saviour. I thought it was a bit of a modern day Let's Get It On, and.
Well,
I
mean, the sound is it pings between kind of Liebach and Prince.
Yes,
and she is, you know, she's an incredible guitarist. It sounds like some of it sounds like Brian Eno, Here Come the Warm Jets. Some of it sounds like Prince.
Yeah,
some of it is really gentle. Some of it sounds like an exploding building. And I was just kind of at a pure musical level bowled over by this thing.
It reminded me a bit in patches, and this I mean as the again the highest of compliments of Jane Siberry, who I think was a much underrated artist. Who I mean, I think if I was going to recommend one Jane Siberry album, The Walking, which I think was about 1988, 1989, it did remind me of that, although Jane Siberry wasn't so much for the sort of Liebach techno disco thing.
Yeah.
Which is a shame in many respects, because I think she'd have done that very well.
I think everybody should do Liebach techno disco at one point. I mean, to what extent? I mean, to me, this seems to be very much a female power, female lust and sexuality, ultra mega woman album. Am I just saying that as a kind of cuckolded beta male here?
No, this is really weird because I don't often listen to female artists, but. Which makes me a terrible, terrible person.
Traitor.
I know.
Gender traitor.
Yeah. But you don't have to just because you're a woman in rock.
Another the word. Three-word description.
Oh, don't get me started.
Women in rock special.
The worst thing ever. Yeah, but I think it's brave
this
as well.
This week on Big Mouth.
Yeah, because she's putting herself out there in many ways and in a very sexual way, and I think it's brave of her as well.
Yeah, I think she's actually glorying in her madnesses and her obsessions.
Yeah,
I
love it.
I didn't feel it was particularly kind of gender slanted one way or the other. I mean, it obviously comes from a female perspective. I did think it was very clever, and I don't mind that, but I wonder if that's why she isn't the megastar that, you know, every colour supplement, Weekend Colour Sup, obviously wishes and thinks she should be. You know, is there a kind of, what is it that's stopping her from being a huge star?
I think that, well, it may yet happen.
I think this could do it. Though.
Yeah, I'd love this really to do it. Because I think, if anything, it's because she does not compromise in any way whatsoever. There's no sort of, sweet radio tune here. There's nothing here is kind of trying to accommodate or patronise the listener. It's unadulterated, and I find that really exciting.
Is it also that she feels the... I kind of understand this. She feels the need to display every one of her talents kind of on every track, you know, so here's a fantastic piece of Prince-type guitar playing.
Which is a very...
Here's some hilarious lyrics.
It's a very Prince variety trait in itself.
Yeah.
Although he was more prone to doing that live than on record, with the sort of inevitable excruciating 15-minute guitar solo.
But I don't think he'd help it. He couldn't help it. He was that talented.
He was musically incontinent.
Yeah.
Yes,
he had
to. But I think if we were offered... If somebody... forgetting this album for a minute, if somebody said, how would you like a female combination of Prince and Sylvia Plath. what do you reckon to that? Who's a multi-instrumentalist, a poet, and a quality lunatic. You'd probably say, yes, please. Yeah. I'd absolutely love that.
You'd want to hear the record, maybe not sit next to them on a long flight.
But then...
I have a problem, though. I've got a problem here. I hate people comparing people to Prince because I just think it never... Is this anyone who's a little bit funky with a bit of a falsetto? And I can see why people
do,
the
only thing that I thought was Prince was some of the guitar...
Yeah.
Stylings, if you like, are very kind of Prince Purple Rain style. The way that she, and I'm here treading into areas that I don't know how to describe, tunes her guitar and gets her guitar sound, just sounds very kind of mid-'80s, early 90s Prince. Which
I think Prince is just an easy reach when you're trying to find the ultimate auteur polymath.
So.
I mean, in the admittedly unlikely event that I was ever compared to Prince, I would I would accept it as a compliment.
Well, as a 5'3" person, I'm compared to Prince all the time. Yeah, he's too wee.
It's the high heels that you're missing, though.
Absolutely, the purple Mac, yes. I think this is a really sexy album as well. You mentioned that.
Oh,
there's something incredibly sexy about her, just not in any way compromising or catering to the listener. And it also seems to be held together by her neuroses. You know, there are songs about death. There are songs about, you know, losing contact with the people you care about. There are songs about being out of control, which, of course, we could all relate to.
All the important stuff's there.
I think this might be it's in contention for my album of the year so far, I think.
Who called her a one-woman Eurythmics? That's brilliant.
I don't know, but I think it fits the bill, doesn't it? Hooray for St. Vincent's.
Yeah.
You know, and follow up by St. Bernard at some point. Anyway, Andrew Mueller.
Yes.
I'm being worn out by sheer female sexual energy on the show here. Let's move on and have your choice of music. What have you got?
Well, actually, there is a measure of female sexual energy in this. This is an Australian songwriter called Paul Kelly. It's from his new album, Life is Fine. And I was minded to pick this because I saw him play at the Shepherd's Bush Empire a few weeks ago in front of a room full of largely delirious Australians. He's one of those people who never really made much impact outside Australia. In Australia, he kind of occupies the role of a slightly less bombastic Bruce Springsteen. He's sort of the national sort of rock and roll uncle, big brother figure. Mm-hmm. Writes wonderfully well about Australians and just about people in general, and the kind of incredibly emotional reaction to a couple of his older songs to people who were clearly born since they were released was extraordinary. But I don't think I'd seen him play live with a full band since the night I finished high school, when we all went to the Tivoli in Sydney to see Paul Kelly and his backing band, which was then called the Coloured Girls, in homage to Lou Reed.
Okay.
And plus, he thought it was funny that, you know, his backing band were a bunch of white guys from Melbourne. His American record company did eventually make him change that. But he played...
that would be a think piece magnet. That would be...
It would, but he played...
Cloud of problematics.
He played at the Shepherd's Bush Empire the other week. He brought with him as part of his band Linda and Vika Bull, who are two recording artists in their own right, sisters, obviously. And one of the interesting things that Paul Kelly has always done is he writes a lot of songs, an unusual amount of songs for a male songwriter anyway, from a female perspective. And weirdly seems to get away with it. I've not met any woman or read any woman taking a front with Kelly's attempts to do that. And it's a really brave thing, I think, for a male songwriter to do, because, God, the manifold ways in which you could get that wrong and make a complete clown of yourself. But and he also, another recurring trope of Kelly's is he re-records versions of his own songs, having thought of some other way of doing them. And this song... Don't Explain appeared on an album years ago by Paul Kelly, though the title of whichever one it was has slipped my mind. But it's re-recorded for the new album, sung by Linda Bull. And this is it.
So this is Linda Bull singing Paul Kelly's Don't Explain. Linda Bull on Paul Kelly's Don't Explain, choice of our guest Andrew Mueller. Now, have you ever wanted to make it in the music business? If you're listening to this podcast, it's probably a bit late for you. But there's no harm in finding out. BBC Four are using the career of perhaps the planet's most beloved musician as a model for the musician's arc. What does Nile Rodgers had to make it in the music business tell us about that career path? We're going to find out after this. This is Nile Rodgers with Chic and I Want Your Love. Chic and I Want Your Love. Hannah Verdier, is Nile Rodgers now the most beloved man in pop music?
I think he is. Well, he is for me anyway. He has been for a long time. But I think he's been appreciated a bit too late. I mean, Chic are one of the best bands ever. Mm. And yeah, it's good to see him actually have all this adulation. But I feel a bit like in about 1985 when Five Star got really famous, it's like, they're mine, they're not the world's. You know, I liked it first. I've got that feeling about
Nile Rodgers, Five Star, same thing.
Yeah, you liked Nile Rodgers when he was on Sub Pop.
Yeah, I prefer his earlier stuff.
When he was Southern Death Nile Rodgers. Yeah, well, I mean, I I think that thing of
I would pay good money to watch a band called Sudden Death, Nile Rodgers.
I think Nile Rodgers would happily do it as well.
Doing the hits of the Cult in the style of Chic, or the other way around. Or both. You can get a cracking disco tune out of She Sells Sanctuary.
Oh, yeah, that is pure disco.
It was goth party night staple, that one, when I was a student. But anyway, back to
the show. Less so Fat Man, I think.
Well, everything benefits from the Nile Rodgers Chic guitar. I mean, I think I disagree with you. I think the fact that he's appreciated late in life is a very beautiful and fitting thing.
Yeah.
Because what we've seen is that the world that he represented, the kind of disco moment, has gone through and come out of that ridiculous period of ridicule it endured for about 10 years. And we now understand that it is the greatest music ever made by anybody. It's dedicated to pleasure, transcendence. It's beautifully made. And this show... kind of goes into that, doesn't it?
However, this show made me so cross, I didn't actually get to the end.
Oh, come on.
All right, why is
because
that?
Because Nile Rodgers is a genius. Nile Rodgers made some of the most timeless and perfect dance records ever. However, I do not feel the need... excuse me. I do not feel the need to once more hear the story of how him and Bernard Edwards didn't get let into Studio 54 on New Year's Eve and went back and wrote
Lay Freak.
And you know, it's just like you've got a man who has quite obviously had a long career with a lot of demons in it, and all you've got is one, I don't know, some kind of Radio 2 live event, which they filmed all the kind of live stuff at, where obviously... his partner Bernard Edwards is no longer with us, so he's not up there. It's Nile doing his kind of smiley backwards Kangol cap, playing the riff from all the songs, which is brilliant. But you know, you've been with everybody with even the slightest modicum of interest in the history of popular music over the last 50 years knows all these stories inside out, and I really don't feel the need to hear them and see them again, and I really don't feel the need for BBC Four to spend part of its, you know, not very extensive budget making a three-part series on a guy so boringly.
I did wonder about the live stuff because obviously Nile Rodgers' thing was creating these amazing records that sound like they were beamed to our earth from a parallel dimension, and whenever it cuts to the modern live stuff, he's sort of grinning through the hits at this audience of middle-aged English white people in tracksuits, sort of like shuffling from foot to foot and holding their phones in the air. It seemed unfitting in some respects.
Well, sort of, I suppose one of the downsides of a dignified middle age is you do end up playing kind of the Waitrose Party in the Park Festival rather than, you know, hanging around with the pimps, pushers and prostitutes in the deuce. You know, that's just a part of the game. I mean, I sort of agree with you in that if you pay any attention to this, then you do know those things. But I kind of thought that watching him actually dismantle songs on the guitar and describe not just how they were written, but how his way of working kind of evolved over the years, in that, you know, he seems to be one of those few people in music who bothers to sit down and ask himself, what is this song about and why
I really like those bits, and they're kind of weird for me to watch because I do, when my revolution comes, Fender Stratocasters are going in the same skip as Umbrellas, but I'm cutting Nile Rodgers a pass on the Strat. He will be the exception to the Stratocaster edict. And there's that amazing statistic, the program quotes that one guitar has generated about $2 billion in music sales.
It was a fantastic story,
which is an extraordinary thought. But I love the bits where
you can get all of that. There is a reason that Total Guitar Wanker only sells kind of like 600 copies a month, you know, and all of that stuff just fitted perfectly well in one of those kind of specialist magazines.
But I like the bits where the bits where he was just sitting there with the guitar playing the bits and the riffs and the songs and explaining how he put them all together, I thought was genuinely really interesting, because it's been one of my favourite things about being a music journalist, that just occasionally I've got to sit opposite the person who actually wrote the song that's come out of 10 billion radios, sitting there with a guitar just playing, you know, returning to the root of the magic. It's a really strange moment when it happens, when you're sitting opposite that person playing that riff.
I think that's right, because, I've done those countless stories, and one of the things you always avoid is asking people how they wrote the song, because on a page it really lies flat and dead. because they tend to say, well, I got an E chord and then I got a B flat.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it kind of all came together in the studio and it's dull as hell. But watching him recount that and explain and show the alternate takes, it was going to be like this, but we changed it. And then finally I realised that the bit where, you know, he can place the girl in He's the Greatest Dancer socially, almost as a market research, she's this kind of person, this is where she's from, this is her background, this is her mind. To me, that is fascinating. And I'm willing to take, you know, the Studio 54 stuff and the My Terrible Childhood stuff, that's the kind of infrastructure, that's the framework around which you can't tell a story.
It's not...
You know what...
But it's the other stuff I found exciting.
I agree, actually, with Matt here, but then I've... Obviously, if you read Le Freak, that's probably a better thing than watching any of these shows. His book's absolutely amazing. But also, I could have really done without the English white people talking about disco. And I'm sorry, but you don't know. I think you've got to have some talking heads on there, but...
It did have a slight...
Didn't need...
It had a cheapness problem. There's not a lot of time and money spent on this. And you can see, you know, we have seen documentaries that have gone into vast, vast depth that have gone off and found the difficult people.
Get Madonna talking about Like a Virgin. I think it could have aimed
and also,
a little higher.
I mean, I don't know. As I said, I kind of like switched it off in a fury before the end. At any point, did they talk about, and I think I know the answer to this because it's made the series is made with the full help and involvement of Mr. Rogers himself. Do they at any point talk about the vast amount of cocaine that he ingested, which caused his heart to stop?
I think part two is what I'm looking forward to, because part two is how do you handle the downside. This is only tangentially how to make it in the music business. It's how to make it in the music business if you're Nile Rodgers to be a genius, which is fine because I'm interested in the Nile Rodgers story. And I'm thinking that part two, which is Decline and Fall, is going to contain all that stuff. If it doesn't, it'll be enormously disappointing.
Yeah, because they had such a hard time when the kind of disco sucks movement came out and they couldn't, you know...
Yeah, but it went beyond that. I mean, because, you know, that was the end of Chic as a band. But his productions went on and on. I mean, I'm still surprised to learn that this song I've known for years was a Nile Rodgers production or a Nile Rodgers co-write, because he was so prolific. That's what kept him in place. But the interesting side of the story is not blah, blah, Comiskey Park, blah, blah, disco sucks. As Matt says, the interesting side is going to be, well, how do you deal with it psychologically when you are ingesting cocaine by the trowelful? You know, I do think it's sad that you kind of wonder where Bernard Edwards would be now, Bernard Edwards, because that bass is so utterly intrinsic to that sound.
Is it a feature of songwriting duos that one of them is invariably, you know, their contribution is lessened? I'm thinking of kind of Bacharach and David, that for some reason... Burt Bacharach, who obviously has a fantastic PR team behind him and is still alive, is like...
I think the second part of it helps.
I think that is crucial.
Yeah.
But you don't... But my theory with that is that you invariably sing the lyrics to Bacharach and David songs. And so Hal David, who provided at least half, and to my mind, more of that kind of teamwork, has been... Not airbrushed from history, but, you know.
So what you're saying is how to make it in the music business. Be a genius, work very hard, get a good look and don't die.
That's how to make it.
The thing that I did think was useful about it, though, with the work very hard thing, at the risk of sounding like someone's dad, it does always strike me as the key thing. Mm. And it gets mistaken a lot even when you think about the people who make incredibly difficult stuff look easy in any field. Mm. If you actually talk to them about it or read enough about how they got there and what they did, it does seem to be the one thing they all have in common. They have worked all the hours God sent.
Well, I did think that irrespective of the fact that it contains things that old people like us know inside out, I did think this is the kind of thing they ought to show at schools, because it is basically the Protestant work ethic times 10. Turn up, do your work, practice a lot, and
this
things might
work
happen.
Now, though, it wouldn't make you rich if you were him now.
It'd make you pretty rich. It might not make you sort of richer than God variety rich that some people got in the 70s and 80s, but I think if you were Nile Rodgers now, you'd be doing okay-ish.
But I wonder whether there's kind of, you know, the idea of being the superstar is oversold, and the idea of being the healthy, continuing, working musician who plays and produces and tours and just does... The thing he says more than anything is, you know, you just want to be out working.
I mean, the thing that has changed, and I think the advantage that people of his generation had, is that there was still so much unconquered territory. You know, nobody had sounded like Nile Rodgers before. That was there to be claimed. There was all sorts of fresh territory which had not, by the 1970s, still been explored. In fact, almost all of it, you could argue. I think finding something genuinely new now, I mean, the mathematics are the mathematics. It just gets harder and harder and harder. Mm. It's like there are probably, you know, parts of planet Earth which no human being has set foot in. But if you went off and conquered one of them, ran up a flag and came back, nobody would care at this point.
Mm. But when somebody discovered disco, it was worth discovering.
Well, indeed.
Mm. Time is cracking on. The clock is running down, which means it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests talk about what has captured their attention this week. Hannah Verde, what has captured your attention this week?
Podcasts, mostly.
Oh, good.
And not just yours.
Thank heavens for that.
I was listening to a great little podcast called The Thread, and it's a bit of a 6 degrees of separation number. It starts off with the shooting of John Lennon, and the episode that it does is absolutely brilliant. It's so evocative. If you remember that day, it brings it all back. And if you don't remember that day, then you're young. Well done. It's kind of an education. And then it takes it back. And eventually, in 6 episodes, it's going to take it back to Vladimir Lenin. And it's already gone through Catcher in the Rye, obviously, because of Mark Chapman, and how J.D. Salinger's The Angst of Holden Caulfield was probably caused by war rather than teenage angst. And it's just brilliant.
So essentially, you have to be really ancient to remember this. It's the James Burke's Connections of the John Lennon murder.
Shall I just look at you blankly now?
Yeah. This is a great show in the 70s where James Burke would follow a development in science. He'd come, and meanwhile, in Magdeburg, this is happening. And meanwhile, exactly at the same time, in Edinburgh, this is happening. He'd follow. It was a thread. Yeah. He followed a thread in scientific development. That sounds like a fantastic and a different way to do the any story. So
is it
one series covering one subject, or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a feeling there'll be another one. But also, the great thing, if you've got the attention span of like a millennial goldfish, it's about 18 to 19 minutes long, which for me, each little segment is no nonsense. So
that's fantastic.
It's really good.
So that's a walk to the sandwich shop at lunchtime.
It is, yeah. You could get two in a lunch break if you want to be extravagant.
Fantastic. The Thread. So don't listen to it until you finish listening to all of Big Mouth and all of Romaniacs, but definitely give it a listen. Andrew Mueller, what have you got for us?
I have actually recently read a couple of rock biographies, which is a genre I usually shy away from because most of them are shockingly tedious. But I did, in keeping with my tradition of getting around to everything late, get around to Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. Which is marvellous. It's really good. It's genuinely very interesting, extremely revealing at a number of levels, and surprisingly funny in patches as well. There's a real warmth and affection about his recollections of starting as a Jersey Shore barroom shaker, especially. It's a really genuinely funny book in parts.
What's your favourite surprise reveal that you've discovered so far?
My favourite surprise reveal, and again, it's just a picture of a different time, was how, by today's standards, how completely massive his early band Steel Mill was, especially, and still couldn't get signed. They could play to 5,000 people a night in New Jersey, and record companies weren't interested.
That's incredible.
Which is amazing. If you think of, like, you know, this is late 60s, early 70s.
There are bands with major record deals on the fronts of rock magazines now who can't play to 5,000 people.
Exactly. But it's a really interesting insight into how things have... The idea that, you know, an A&R person would turn up, see a local band sending 5,000 people completely crazy and just go, nah.
I'm not feeling it. I can't smell a hit.
Whatever. The other one I've read, which again is bewildering and hilarious, and a picture of a time now vanished. Jimmy Webb's The Cake and the Rain.
It's a recipe book.
No, it is. That is, of course, a quote from the much mocked chorus of his own MacArthur Park. And, you know, Jimmy Webb, obviously one of the greatest songwriters who ever drew breath. He wrote By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Galveston, Wichita Lineman, you know, and any number of others for everybody ever. I had the fortune of interviewing him a few weeks ago for future broadcast on Monocle 24. I'm not sure when. If I'd been organised, I'd have found that out. But anyway, it'll be on air eventually.
It'll be on a website.
It'll be on a website as well. He does not stint on his years of cocaine abuse and the effect it had on him, which were very nearly terminal. But again, it's a reflection of how fast things used to move. He goes from being, as he tells it, a 15-year-old Oklahoma farm boy sitting on his tractor listening to Glen Campbell coming out of his AM radio. And by the time he's 17, he's conducting the actual wrecking crew on a few of his early recordings. By the time he's 19, By the Time I Get to Phoenix is a hit for almost everybody. And I think by the time he's 21, if I've got the chronology right, the house he's living in Los Angeles is the former Filipino consulate, which he's just bought.
I've got to read that.
It's a genuinely amazing book because it's just there was this window was opened for a very brief period in which, I say, 18-year-old Oklahoma farm boy with a catchy tune. Here is a vast sack of cash.
Yeah,
and
a 60-piece orchestra.
And a 60-piece orchestra, and Frank Sinatra wants to meet you in his suite in the Waldorf. Go and play him a few tunes. You know, this kind of thing happened to him.
Good Lord.
It's an amazing book. It really, really is.
That sounds interesting. Matt Hall, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Last Tuesday, it was an event that happens annually in America called the BET Rap Awards, and Eminem, who has been not heard of and not kind of like that visible over the last few years, did a pre-recorded kind of freestyle for them in a car park, backed by his homies and a load of high-end automobiles, but basically in 4 minutes, no beats, tore Donald Trump a new one. And I know it's very easy to do that, and you
there's
know,
no shortage
kind
of
like,
material.
Certainly. No, there isn't. You'll be glad, Andrew, to see that there was a lot of comic book references.
All right.
In that he said racism's the only thing he's fantastic for because that's how he gets his fucking rocks off and he's orange. Obviously a reference to The Thing.
That's my thing.
But you know, and I was kind of watching it and going, yeah, okay, you know, this is good, but what's it going to do? And then at the end, he basically goes, if you're a fan of mine and you're a supporter of his, here's a line in the sand, you can't be both. And makes that point very, very vehemently. And I just kind of think that's an interest. You know, he covers everything. He covers the wall. He covers the Black Lives Matter. He covers taking a knee. You know, but it's quite an interesting, I think, development in that somebody that pop culture important actually coming out and not mincing his words.
I'm looking forward to Donald Trump's tweeted response that Eminem is always overrated and sad and failing.
I'm just looking forward to how he spells Eminem. It could go
one of several ways.
It could go one of several. Puffy, yeah. We'll stick that on the Facebook page then. The viewers can have a listen. I'm going to take a bit more time over my closing time chat because it fits in with the BBC Four thing we're just talking about. You were, Matt, complaining about the cheapiness of the Nile Rodgers one. On Sky Arts last weekend was a fantastic documentary about XTC, the great British Beach Boys. Basically, they are the British Beach Boys. They developed from a punk band into the most complicated and rich and ennobling pop music that we have. Matt is wincing here. They just are. They're the British Beach Boys.
If only you had a magazine to propound. I know. If only you had something on the web that you could propound that theory.
I've been propounding it for years. I mean, this is a fantastic film. It's called This Is Pop. And it opens with Andy Partridge saying how much he hates rockumentaries. I hate them. They're rubbish. And then one of them's always died and they hate each other and they fall out and they're always whinging about money. And it's just, and the tone is set of great deprecating sense of humour. You see their weird path and their unique ideas. Unlike the Nile Rodgers documentary, it's not cheap. They have spent money on this. They built an entire model railway in order to move around little models.
It does look beautiful. I watched it last night.
Did you enjoy it as a television programme?
Very much, except I've never quite been able to put my finger on it. I like XTC very much. I admire their records very much. There's something about them that I find slightly off-putting, and I can't quite figure out what it is. There's
one word, Swindon.
Stop being racist against Swindon.
I don't know Swindon that well or have any particular views on the subject, but there is a certain sort of sneering, superior chippiness about them, which comes across
Do you really
somewhat,
think they
yeah.
come from Swindon? The whole thing is like, we come from the most boring place in the world, from the most ordinary, sort of semi-rural stock of people, and we are, you know, there's nothing. They don't lord it over anybody. So here are our songs.
Yeah, they don't lord it in their songs either, do they?
No, they don't. It's really kind of it's very English.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just perceiving something passive aggressive in their refusal to lord it in their songs. Hannah, it's a passive aggressive self deprecation.
I don't know what you're saying there. Did you manage to say it, Hannah?
I'm halfway through it actually, and it just guiltily reminded me how good they are. And took me back to, is it Drums and Wires, that album?
That's it's a great record.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that I loved it. And when I heard the songs, it reminded me of being seven again, which is weird, but sorry. But also, I thought it was so different to the Nile Rodgers one. Maybe because I don't know so much about them. I gave it like the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
But the way they came across, and it was joyous.
So I think they are, Andy Partridge does say, maybe this is a bit self-aggrandizing, but he does say at one point, you know, I'm not going to hold back. I think we're one of those bands that started out pretty good and we got better and better. And in the end, we became really, really good. And I think he's absolutely right, because the late XTC albums, like Skylarking and Origins and Lemons, and even their kind of fake 60s psych album, their Dukes of Stratosphere album, which is amazing, which is most beautiful.
That's a great record. I love the Dukes of Stratosphere.
There's a great little bit. Have you seen John Leckie in it yet? Saying that when he was called in to produce the first Stone Roses album, the Stone Roses go, "Hey, we like Dukes of Stratosphere. Can you make it sound like?"
If only, yes, I can.
If only he had the Dukes of Stratosphere remix. I did interview Andy Partridge about a billion years ago. It was a phone interview from Australia where I was still living at the time, and it was not long after that incident, which is mentioned in the film, in which that slightly upset American kid took his headmaster hostage with a knife, I think, to get him to play Dear God over the school PA. And I did ask Andy Partridge, in all innocence, you know, were you sort of personally upset when you heard of this incident? To which his reply was, damn right, he should have taken a tank and the whole back catalogue.
Well, I thought this was a fantastic film, and the incredible thing is BBC Four rejected it. This was offered to BBC Four, and they decided, I mean, like, I love BBC Four's music strands, but they have shown some right
stinkers.
Old stinkers in time. Stuff that's been cheap, stuff that has been rather dull. This is Technicolor, funny. It's like a real-life Brian Penn, because every daft thing happens, but the band know that it's what, you know, they're kind of living through the cliches of rock band, and they have a sense of humour about it. It's still available, so run, don't walk to your skybox and get XTC, This Is Pop. And I am angry at the BBC for not showing this, because this is exactly what a publicly funded broadcaster ought to be showing. So there we go. That is another show in the bag. Thank you to Hannah Verdier and Andrew Mueller for joining us. Please come again. You're always welcome. Remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts on your phone, and you can hear us on Spotify too. We're going to play out with a bit of XTC because we can. This is on the documentary This Is Pop, and it might even be the best song that Andy Partridge has ever written. This is from the album Nonesuch in 1992, and this is Wrapped in Grey. See you all next week. Bye. So